Good morning and thanks for joining us. I'm Danielle Kading and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. In this hour, we'll hear from a candidate running for Iron County District Attorney, plans to clean up and develop Ashland's waterfront, and more. Up first, we speak with Elaine Erickson. Erickson is running against fellow Democrat Tony Stella in next Tuesday's primary race for Iron County District Attorney. The current DA, Marty Lipsky, is retiring from the office. Erickson joined us by phone yesterday to tell us about her background and why she's running.
I'm originally from California, and my husband and I moved to the Midwest over 26 years ago. And we steadily traveled upward. We lived in Wisconsin for a couple of years, and then we moved up to Ironwood, Michigan for the last over 10 years. And he is originally from this area. We have two children who are in college. One is at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, and the other is at Michigan Tech University. And I've been an attorney for over 25 years. I got a bachelor's from Georgetown University, a master's in business from Pepperdine, and a Juris Doctor from Loyola Law School. And I've had a wonderful career as an attorney. I've worked in a very well-known law firm in Minneapolis in the Twin Cities, and I represented mostly municipalities and school districts. I went from there to the Minnesota Attorney General's office, and I represented colleges and universities. And then when we moved to Wisconsin, I had my own law firm, and I did a variety of different subjects. Types of law. And then when we moved over here, I started in Iron County, and I do what's called guardian ad litem work, which means I represent children's best interests in family law and mostly actually children in need of protection.
Okay.
And that's how I got here.
Yeah, and if you were elected DA, that would obviously mean that you'd be trying criminal cases. And do you have any background in criminal law?
Well, I've done similar type work. I've done expulsions and in universities and expulsions in school districts. That's certainly not at the, it's not a reasonable doubt standard, but certainly involved a trial and, criminal-like conduct. But I'm a very, very talented attorney. Attorneys do this all the time. They become competent in other areas of the law. It's certainly a professional work, but it's not brain surgery. And any lawyer who's worth their salt is going to look at the statutes every time they try a case to make sure that they're correct. And of course, I would shadow the current district attorney to make sure that I'm understanding how things are done in that office if I'm elected, that there's 2 months before I would take office, so I would certainly make sure I'm up to speed on how things are done on the criminal side. But half of that job, or some part of that job, is doing children in need of protection, children's issues, and so I would be very up to speed on that side of the law.
And, you know, being that Iron County is a neighbor to Michigan, I understand that you are also a Michigan resident, which is kind of curious for a Wisconsin race.
Well, I just wanted to add something back to what I was just saying. My opponent talks about being a district attorney in the 80s and 90s, so he would have to get up to speed also. I'm sure the law has changed since then, and I'm not sure the when the last time was that he tried a case. So, you know, all attorneys have to get, or always, well, that's why it's called practice, because you're always getting up to speed. You're always improving your skills and fine-tuning. And in terms of your question for that, yes, we are, you know, right next to each other. It's a curiosity up here in northern Wisconsin that Michigan is just right over the border. But the law does not prohibit that. It says you need to be a resident by the time you take office. In fact, I will be moving over there. That is the law, and I will be doing that. And, you know, in this day and age, lots of couples do that, where one person might live and work in South Dakota or North Dakota and the other person lives here, that is something that is not unusual in this day and age where two people in a marriage are working. So I'm very excited about moving to Iron County. As I said, I've been practicing there for over 6 years. So I care about the residents, and I know the issues, and I'm looking forward to it.
So what do you see as some of the major issues, then, for the Iron County DA's office?
Well, as I said, I've been doing a lot of children in need of protection, and there's a lot of crossover. And frankly, it's meth and heroin, drugs, and how they affect the children in the area, families in the area. And then, of course, all the collateral damage, so to speak, all the other criminal aspects that come off of that, dealing, driving while under the influence, potentially burglary, those sorts of things that all come from drug addiction. And that's, I think, the biggest challenge for this area. And Ironwood, where I'm living, has been working together with Iron County, Gilgibbon County and Iron County. They work closely together to try to resolve this issue. And if I took office, when I take office, one of the things that is my strong point is being a working together to bring people to the table and collaborating. So I would bring law enforcement, the Human Services Department, other social services departments, residents to the table to discuss what the issues are and try to come up with ways to resolve the issues, listening and trying to come up together with a way to make the community safer. But also, my personal belief system is in consistent justice and consequences. And so I would be definitely looking towards strategies that include that, as well as prevention, trying to really resolve the issue instead of a Band-Aid situation, but including the residents in that problem-solving process.
And, you know, just looking at some of what Iron County has dealt with, at least in the last 6 months, there have been a little more than 30 felonies that have been filed. And it's an area that's familiar with violent crime, where you see issues of sex assaults or murders. Most recently, I think, was a case that was highly publicized. Where a Saxon man was charged with fatally stabbing a waitress at the Bear Trap Inn after burning the business down.
Right.
So what would you hope to accomplish through this office if elected?
Again, working together with law enforcement to understand the issues and to make sure that I'm not undermining their efforts. I believe in consequences. I also believe in consistent justice. No favoritism. One person gets slapped on the hand, the other person doesn't. I don't believe in that. I believe that we have a set of rules and that they're enforced for everyone. Really working closely with law enforcement. I can't underscore that enough, so that I'm not undermining what they're doing. And they understand how I'm going to react with what they're doing, so that we're really on the same page. And I'd like to also work on prevention, working more broadly with national law enforcement, statewide law enforcement, understanding what works in other places and bringing that to Iron County. And trying to resolve these issues. We aren't the only ones who are going through this. I was listening to your interview with the Bayfield District Attorney, and he talked about the same problems. That's what we're dealing with in the northern area here. And a lot of it has to do with the drug problem, methamphetamine and heroin. Those are serious, serious drugs, and the addictions are very serious. And people will do a lot of things while under the influence or trying to get the drug. And I think that's really a majority of the issues here and trying to get a handle on that. But working together with all of those counties and trying to resolve the issues region-wide, I think, is really important.
So what moved you to run then? I mean, when did you make this decision, and what was it that made you want to make the leap from representing children or families with family law to criminal law?
Well, representing children and children in need of protection, that has a great crossover with criminal law. Oftentimes, drugs are at the center of those issues. So there's a big crossover, but mostly because my whole career has been representing public entities or working for public entities such as at the Minnesota Attorney General's office. I believe very strongly in public service, and that has been where my career has been, and that's a very major part of my my being. I'm very ethical. I have a lot of integrity, and I've always been proud of the fact that when I work and live somewhere, that I positively contribute both through my job and through volunteer work. I have a lot of volunteer work under my belt, and through both those types of work, I believe strongly that this is a position that I could really make a difference.
Well, if, you know, people haven't made up their minds yet by now, as they're heading to the polls next Tuesday in the primary race against challenger Tony Stella, why would you encourage them to vote for you? How do you stand out as a candidate?
Well, I really think where I live currently is a non-issue. As I said, I'm committed to moving there. I have to by law. It's required that I'm a resident. And frankly, I think that law is a bonus for the county, because it means that they have a larger pool of talented attorneys who are looking to be their district attorney, and I'm a good example of that. I'm a very talented, hard worker. I am very dedicated to the position that I do, and I have a lot of perseverance. I'm well respected. I've been in the court in Iron County for the last over 6 years. The judge knows me, and I'm well respected by the court and by my colleagues there. And I am, as I said, interested in collaboration, consistent justice, prevention. I really think that I can make a difference for Iron County. And in terms of not being a district attorney before that, it's, again, as I said, it's not brain surgery. It's something that I am willing to work hard to become adept at, so that when I hit the first day, I hit it running. And I really think I can do a great job, and that I would be a hard worker and dedicated to it. I also want to say that through this process, I've been going door to door and meeting the residents of Iron County, and it's been a humbling experience to meet folks and to listen to them. And it really drives home that this is it's an honor. It's an honor to run and to be elected, and to have people trust in you. And I'm well aware of that honor.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us about why you're running and what you hope to accomplish if elected. Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
No, just thank you very much. And I encourage people to get out August 9th and vote in the primary. It's not the general election. It's not the big one, but it's still very, very important. And I just encourage people to get out there and vote.
And whoever would come out on top in the primary would face the Republican challenger, which I believe I might pronounce his last name wrong, but it's Matt Jingstad?
Jingstad, yes. That would be the Republican candidate. And that would be the person who would run in November. He's not challenged in the primary, so he would be the one to beat in November.
Well, again, I appreciate your time, Elaine. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I really appreciate this.
Again, that was Elaine Erickson, candidate for Iron County District Attorney. We invited her opponent, Tony Stella, to be interviewed as well, but he did not return our phone calls. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, and when we come back, we'll hear about ongoing efforts to clean up and develop Ashland's waterfront. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning and thanks for joining us. I'm Danielle Kading and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. The Natural Resources Board held its board meeting in Ashland on Wednesday to vote on several rules concerning deer fencing, Cisco management, land sales, and more. On Tuesday, the board toured the Ashland waterfront to observe cleanup of the Northern States Power Lakefront Superfund site. The Wisconsin DNR's Jamie Dunn has been the state's project manager for more than two decades. He talked about a wet dredge pilot study taking place in the bay by Crare Park. The study is looking at whether contaminated sediments can be removed in the water without releasing more toxins into the lake. Dunn says on a good day, workers are hauling 20 semis filled with dredged material to a landfill south of Duluth.
Upon completion of the pilot test, it will be determined whether they can extend out with this process through the other 16 acres. If that's the case, hopefully next year they can finish the dredging out here. The next phase after that would be take everything out of the park, reconstruct the park per the city's lakefront development plans. We've worked with the city since the early 90s through the design process on this. You know, we knew they wanted to redevelop it, and we wanted to make sure during the remediation process we didn't do anything that precluded kind of the outcome of this, and I think that relationship has worked very well. We have, for me, this site, this is the most public outreach I think we've done on a site, and it has worked out very well.
The Ashland Chamber's Mary McFetridge talked about efforts to communicate what's happening with the cleanup project through a community advisory group.
Rick Johnson. Rick Johnson is the principal at Our Lady of the Lake School, administrator, I should say. And I'm glad Rick's here because he can attest to this excellent partnership that we've shared with all of the partners throughout this process. And I think our first meeting was, oh my gosh, January of 2013, when the committee came together. And we really wanted to be open and talk to the community about what their concerns were. Really, back up the truck a little bit further, there were times that I've been the chamber director for 17 years, and I really didn't know if I would see this project come to fruition. I think there was a lot of residents that were like, maybe we'll be collecting Social Security before we see this thing, you know, put to bed. But so we were all really excited and like, oh my gosh, it's really here, and we're really going to see something happen on the bay. So there has been this anticipation, and I think the most important thing was really communicating with the community about what was going to happen and how it was going to take place. And so the partnership here with the DNR and the EPA and all the community folks that are involved has been extraordinary. Xcel Energy has been really great to work with from the get-go as far as the smells. Jamie is awesome. He comes out and he just says it like it is, and he really gave really from his heart, and he talked because he's been so intimately related with this project for so many years, and he said, hey, this is how it's going to be. There will be smells. We're going to do the best we can. There will be all sorts of guidelines, permitting going on, and we will make sure that you're safe, but we want to hear from you, the community, when you have a problem. And so there were very few issues in the first part of the phase one, very few. And I tell you what, they had, I think, what did you have, five guys answering the 800 line? And we laughed because we were like, well, who knows when they're going to answer them. But anyway, it was quite funny. But they had their 800 line that Xcel Energy set up for anybody that wanted to call and have a complaint or a smell or an odor or an issue. And it was taken care of immediately. So we have been very, and Rick's shaking his head because he was part of that, and he can attest. What's that?
Only two evacuations.
Yeah, so a bit everything has gone very smoothly. As a community, I think that we're really proud of the partnership between all the players involved here.
The Ashland Superfund site will cost around $100 million or more to clean up, and XL Energy is the sole party financially responsible for the project after years of legal disputes between the city of Ashland, Ashland County, two railroads, and the utility company. David Donovan is the general manager of customer community service with XL.
I wasn't when I first got involved in this site 16 years ago, so I've gone through a couple different positions since then. But nobody ever wants to take this site over, so I can't get rid of it within the company. So I'm stuck with it, I think, until I retire or until we get it done. So I'm pushing to get it done as quickly as we can. I've been asked to talk a little bit about our relationships with the communities as well as with the agencies and how we've actually been able to keep the project moving forward. As most of you saw, Jamie held up the pictures here. Prior to this all starting, I would say that our relationship with the agencies were stressed, maybe is the best way to put it. There were good days, there were bad days. People said things that probably were said the wrong way in the wrong environment. People took things the wrong way in the wrong environment, and it just didn't support trying to get things done. Once we all got going in the same direction, things really started to take off and things got done quickly. There were a lot of things that went on up here that we didn't anticipate. I think as we dug through this area in the ravine, we came across some old bottles that were really antiques. They had a lot of lead in them. Well, that would contribute to an exceedance, and so we had to deal with that. And Jamie and the staff and the EPA saw that as an issue. We came up with a solution. We dealt with it as quickly as we possibly could, and we kept the project going forward. But that's the type of thing that really builds trust. It builds rapport. It builds the belief that everybody wants to see this thing done quickly, done right, and done once, so we don't have to do it over and over and come back and fix problems. And that's been the objective as we go forward. I think that's kind of that's something you've seen throughout the whole process once we got rolling, especially as we reached out to the community. The CAG has been fantastic in reaching out and making sure we've got the people engaged, that we're hearing things that concern the community. It's helped us put together brochures like this. I think this is in your packet of materials this meeting. This was put together through the Department of Health, but they relied heavily on input from both the DNR and EPA and us. They didn't keep us out of the process, which is critical for us because there are things that we see that we think we should have said in a brochure like this as we reach out to the community and our customers, actually, our natural gas and electric customers, that we want them to know about the site and what to expect. So it was very gratifying then to be brought in and help develop this type of material as we try to communicate with the community and our customers. One of the key customers that we have is the school right up at top of the hill. We are very conscious of the school's presence, what is being done there, teaching of our youth. And so we're very sensitive to anything that Rick tells us. If they smell something, we've impressed upon our staff, they have to react. They can't let it wait because we need to get out there and make sure that we know what's going on, because they're not going to tell us something. Adults are maybe more, used to that type of smell. Children are not. And so when the children tell us something, we want to be responsive. We want to get out there and make sure that we're protecting them. So we do go out and try to be responsive to Rick and whenever he calls us, as quickly as we possibly can. It's another example of us trying to reach out to the community. One of the things that we did on phase one, we actually, and I think Jamie was involved in this as well, is that we would go out and actually meet with our neighbors face to face so that they knew what to expect coming down. What we didn't expect when we started the pilot is that we would have to repeat that process. We just assumed that once people knew we were down there working, that they would get used to what the orders and what that meant. That's a bad assumption. We need to go out there and educate the community again. Every time you do something different, you need to get out there before you start it and educate the community so they know what to expect. We were not prepared for the number of order complaints that we got on the pilot this time around as compared to the phase one and the terrestrial, the upland removal and treatment. It just I didn't expect that there would be that much difference between the odors or the frequency, and there was. And so we needed to get out. It's one of the things we learned through the pilot. It told us that we have to do better education as we go forward, especially if we're going to go do the full dredge. We need to make sure the community is fully aware of what's going to happen out there before we actually do that work. Community has been very responsive in terms of providing employees for us as well. I think we have actually 12 employees from the local community that operate equipment down here. I've been told by our staff that some of them are the best operators they've seen and that they've dealt with. They know how to do the equipment and materials handling very well. So we keep them on staff as much as we can. We have a total salary of any month between $25,000 and $28,000, depending on the number of employees we have down there, which ranges anywhere from 35 to 55, depending on what we're doing and who's doing what. The total economic impact for the local region being about 100 miles, is about $15 million from the site thus far through the end of June of 2016. That is for equipment, the heavy equipment that we use, maintenance of that equipment, fuel for the equipment, materials that we might order from as far away as maybe Wausau or just north of Wausau for the anchor rock and the material that went into the breakwater, cement, specialized expertise like heating and air conditioning when we built the long-term treatment system. So we really have a significant impact on the local region. It's quite significant. We anticipate that's only going to grow over the next year and a half. We have asked our engineering staff that if we're allowed to move forward on a full wet dredge, that we can do that in 1 year. And we're trying to get them to design that. We're finding bottlenecks in the process that we're working with the agencies on to try to work through. We're still looking for a quick result, end of the project, but to do it once and only do it once. We want to make sure that we don't have to come back and do it multiple times or to dredge multiple times. Nobody benefits from that. It adds cost to the process. So while we're trying to get them to do it in 1 year, it may take us longer than we anticipate, but at least it puts pressure on us. It puts pressure on our technical staff to make sure we get the work done in the right way.
Ashland Mayor Deb Lewis says cleanup of the Ashland Superfund site is an issue that's been weighing on the city for decades.
There were some dark days where we feared apocalypse, but fortunately we're past that. In many ways, we feel as though a dark cloud has been lifted from the city. It's encouraged a lot of optimism. I think some new development has resulted. People were holding back from development and in some cases from even choosing to move here out of fear of what was going to happen here. So we're really glad that we're this close to being finished. And the success has been in large measure. I have to give Jamie Dunn his due. Jamie has been a part of our community for probably over 20 years, right? And because of that, because he's been here from the beginning, he has earned his credibility in the community. And I think, as David has said, the people of Ashland made one thing clear about this project from the beginning. We were willing to put up with the lengthy process of cleanup, provided it was done once and done right. And that's been sort of the mantra throughout this. So now we're at a point where we can work with NSPW to ensure the project is completed efficiently and safely. And we're at a point where we get to start the fun part of dreaming for the future of what comes next. So I'm going to have our planning director tell you a little bit about our plans when I'm finished here. But it all starts for us in the community, I think, with the premise that it all starts in the lake for us. The water is the most important thing. And I understand you had a little welcoming committee this afternoon on your tour. That's just a kind of a small sense of the passion that people in this area have for the water and protecting the water. I want to just take this opportunity to thank the DNR for some other partnerships. We feel like we've been blessed this year by John and some of his, and John G, some of the work they've done to help us out. We have an old industrial site called the Roffer site over on the west side of town. And it's an old railroad yard. And several years ago, the land was donated to the city
And unfortunately, that too was in need of remediation. And Ashland County is one of the poorest counties in the state. So John worked with us carefully, John Robinson, and we were just awarded a $400,000 remediation grant that, with the final remediation beginning this August, and we hope to have that property available for redevelopment next spring. We also have another old industrial site that you've probably driven by on the east side of town called the Timeless Timber Site. It's right across from the Culvers. That's another old industrial site of about 40 acres, and we just got word that we received some WOM funds for phase two environmental assessments. And yesterday we heard we got a $150,000 WEDC grant that will help us with redevelopment of that site. And then finally, last but not least, our ore dock. We had an old ore dock, like many of these communities up here. In 2014, CN Railroad was in the process of demolishing it, and they offered the city the opportunity to keep the base. After some discussion and talk with the citizens, it was decided to accept it. They gave us a lump sum of money. We are in the process of redeveloping that, and we were also blessed this year to receive some WOM monies for that to assess some of the upland areas that we intend to develop around the new ore dock.
Ashland City Planner April Kroner has been overseeing plans to redevelop the city's waterfront by the ore dock and Superfund sites.
This is an area of interest for all of the residents in our community, so we've had extensive public outreach on this and public input gathering to find out how do people want to use this site when the cleanup is completed. So we went through numerous renditions, had design charrettes and everything that were done, and really got out to the public in many different realms to find out what they wanted to do with this space. What we've come up with is a mix of both boating and marina use and open space for events along the waterfront. Right now we don't have a lot of public just open space areas to hold large events. We have a great waterfront trail that connects the entire waterfront, but no place to really stop and, you know, have a play area or hold a large concert or event down there. So this is the conceptual plan that was recently approved in the early summer of 2016. What it includes would be, again, those open space areas, a trail system throughout, getting our connection back on our waterfront trail. So right out here in front, it's been detoured the past few years with the Superfund site, and Jamie has been more than willing to work with us to say, we'll get that piece, you know, at least graveled in next year for you so you can get that connection back. Our main things would be a boat launch, a four-bay boat launch. We really don't have a whole lot of boat launch area within this city. What we do have has insufficient parking, is lacking some of the amenities. So we're hoping to get a 3 or 4 bay boat launch in here with a fish cleaning station. We're also looking for an indoor boat storage facility for our marina. On this Superfund site, prior to the construction beginning, the boats were just stored outside along that property, but we don't have any indoor heated storage, so this would allow an opportunity for that, as well as outdoor trailer parking that'll be sufficient for the boat launch area. Then a Four Seasons Pavilion right out along the waterfront. So those are kind of the main things. When we look at this site overall, it would be approximately 3.5 acres that would be dedicated to boating and marina use, and about 5.8 acres that would be dedicated to public open space activities. Once we had this done, we were working with Excel and also with the DNR. There's a lot of stuff out there, big monitoring wells. I think you all did the site visit, so you can see them kind of popping up throughout the property there. A lot of utilities that are already underground. So what we did after we had the conceptual plan done is we then overlaid it with the existing site, like the infrastructure that's in place. So things are currently being modified. We're going to get all of these same features, but we're going to locate them a little bit better. Jamie was great in helping us out with that, saying, hey, we already have, you know, water run here, so maybe move that, you know, pavilion to a location where you already have sewer and water available. Let's move the boat launch over to a location that's better suited. You know, get the building out of the way for some of the residents above so they can, I guess, so they'll see over it a little bit more. So it's not the full color version, but we're getting through some of those details there so we can better work with the site. Again, the DNR has been really helpful in, you know, pushing us to get this plan done and assuring us that as part of the cleanup process, when they get that done in 2018, they'll work with us to try to grade the site to be what we need so that we can then move ahead with our plans to implement this project out here.
Is that funded?
This plan is not funded currently, so we will have a lot of work to do. We'll be probably applying for a lot of grants. It will probably be something that's done in phases. You know, initially we may just have a lot of public open space and we may have a small boat storage building. You know, our marina is hoping to be able to finance that portion of it. We're hoping we can apply for some funds to get the boat launch piece completed. So yeah, right now we don't have any way of funding this. So we seem to have a lot more projects out there than we have money to do. So, but we are getting there, which leads me to another project that we're working on, which is the ORDOC. You can see on this model here, this is the ORDOC that used to exist. Just over out that way, goes almost 2,000 feet. It is 2,000, isn't it? Wow. 2,000 feet out into Lake Superior. It's about 66-foot wide base. The structure that was on it was approximately 80 feet tall, steel structure, and then the ore boats would come up there. The trains brought everything in, and that was the main piece. So the public is looking to utilize this as more of a tourist destination. A regional draw, and also just for everyone in the community to utilize. So, you know, historically people were always out on this dock fishing, you know, doing things they weren't supposed to be out there, but I guess they were. It's just a great area. The second half of the ORDOC is built with what we call the diamonds. There's approximately 71 open diamonds where the water can flow through. That was part of the construction. You can kind of see some of them out here on this design. People want to continue to fish in those. Right now people want to get to the end of the dock. We have a fence up about halfway. The Corps of Engineers has said it's really unsafe, so until which time we redevelop it, we can't really get the public out there. So they're really pushing for that. Over the past year and a half, we've been working with Smith Group, JGR, and Westbrook on designing the concept plans for what we want to do here, and it not only includes the base of the ORDOC, but also the entire upland area up to US Highway 2. The city's been working hard to acquire some of those lands as well. And then also some areas near shore around the ORDOC base. So I'm not gonna go through all of these individual concepts for you, but this was a lot of public input, a lot of back and forth. What do you want? And I mean, some people wanted the Ferris wheels and the restaurant that we could take on a train track out to the end and back. Obviously there, you know, some of those things we cannot do here. So we have had to educate the public and let them know, you know, there are certain things we can and can't use this for. Some of those, you know, maybe it's the food vending. They may not be able to have a restaurant out there, but we can offer opportunities for transient food vending right at the base of the dock, which you can see we're trying to incorporate into our plan. So if people want to be out there and have some sort of refreshments, they have that availability. Also the upland area, we really see a potential there for some commercial and or residential or mixed use type development. And we're already getting some interest on that, but we're saying, hold on, you know, let us get through our planning, let us figure out how we want to see this area develop. I do have a really short video, it's maybe a minute and a half long, that gives you like a 3D of what this ORDOC looks like, and it, you know, it gives you the overview, and then it walks you through the dock, different seasons of the year, night, day. We do intend to use this for a variety of events. We've already started to have some bands play out there, but right now it's just a big gravel dock, so it's not very inviting. We'd love to have, you know, potential farmers markets out there. We've had a movie on the dock already, all sorts of events. And the ideas for this are that we can someday bring in tall ships, that we can, you know, have them stop here for maybe a couple weeks at a time and, you know, again, have that tourist draw. Maybe do some boat tours out to the islands and pull in that. So we've really been working with a ton of stakeholders and people are just really excited to work on this. Northland College is involved, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, like you name it, they're involved and everybody wants to play a part in it. We are the Ashland Ore Dockers is our high school. They're going to have to change their logo a little bit because that big structure isn't there. Maybe we can put this cool design on it. But it is something very important to the Ashland community. And as you can see on here, we're trying to pull in pieces of the history with it, with the old rail tracks and kind of putting those along the dock, utilizing the old ore dock chutes. There's actually some people in the community that have saved those. So we have those elements. These are the original light poles that were on top of the ore dock base. We've got about 20 of those. So we want to put them on the dock, but also carry that up through up to the upland area, out to US Highway 2, and really get people along Highway 2 to kind of pull in and see what we have here with our ore dock.
That was Ashland City Planner April Croner talking about efforts to redevelop the city's waterfront. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but stick around, there's more to come. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Up next, we have the news of the week as covered by the Superior Bureau of Wisconsin Public Radio. Up first, a Superior shipyard was slapped with a nearly $1.4 million fine on Monday for failing to protect workers from lead exposure. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration, known as OSHA, says a few employees on the Herbert C. Jackson had lead exposures up to 20 times the legal limit. The agency's area director out of Eau Claire, Mark Heisel, says Fraser officials knew lead was present on the ship.
They had previously been cited for the exact same violations that were cited in this case, and they didn't do anything to protect the employees.
Heisel says 75% of 120 workers tested by the company were exposed to lead. Fraser was previously fined for multiple lead violations in 1993. Fraser Shipyards claims they halted work as soon as high lead levels were detected, brought in medical experts, and bought safety gear to protect workers. On Monday, community members and Superior were handing out blue light bulbs for the city's Night of Blue event. People were asked to leave a blue light on Tuesday to show support for law enforcement. Superior's Night of Blue is being held on National Night Out, an annual campaign to build relationships between the community and police to keep neighborhoods safe. Co-organizer Keith Kern says officers could use more support after recent police killings.
They do a wonderful job keeping our community safe. You know, their job isn't easy, and just really like to see the whole town lit up in blue to show their support.
Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander says officers are facing more scrutiny and criticism.
But I think overall, our community recognizes that law enforcement's out there doing the right thing and keeping people safe and helping their communities on a daily basis.
Alexander says more than 1,200 light bulbs are being passed out around the city. And the Natural Resources Board met with state and local officials in Ashland on Tuesday ahead of Wednesday's board meeting to get an update on flood damage and recovery from the July 11th storm. The DNR Secretary's Director for Northern Wisconsin, John Gosjelski, says the storm has racked up an estimated $35 million in damage to date. He says stream flows on the White River near Ashland jumped to more than 25 times the normal rate in a matter of 5 hours.
Quite frankly, we are very lucky we didn't lose more dams. We only lost a private cranberry dam in Washburn County. We had a lot of dams up in this particular part of the flood area. We're very fortunate we didn't lose more dams. I attribute that to the operation of the owners saw that we had the flood coming. They opened up those gates, tried to pass as much water as possible.
The DNR's Gosjelski says the Bad River peaked at just over 27 feet the day after the storm, the highest flood stage ever recorded. Iron County Forest Administrator Eric Peterson says they've been working with the Wisconsin Department of Transportation to put in a temporary bridge to restore access at the marina at Saxon Harbor. Peterson says rebuilding the harbor, marina, and campground may cost up to $20 million.
Iron County would be looking at $2.5 million out of pocket, potentially. So our county board's going to have to make a decision on what they feel they can afford, and Iron County's only got 5,800 residents, so we're not a very wealthy county.
The storm sank 6 boats and sent many more floating out into Lake Superior. A spokeswoman for the U.S. Coast Guard says only 1 boat and 2 cars remain unaccounted for. And the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa was one of the hardest impacted areas after flooding hit northern Wisconsin. As Marcus White reports, efforts are underway to ensure that not only are homes repaired, but the traditions of the band live on.
The band is working with the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the State Department of Transportation to continue to fix damage to roads, especially in heavily impacted rural areas. 46 homes were affected by the flooding. At least 9 have been destroyed. Bad River Flood Command Center spokesman Dylan Jennings says that the damage is much more than just about the homes.
People not only lost their childhood homes, but they also lost material things that we kind of take for granted every day. Everything from picture albums to ceremonial things to our everyday commodities that we have.
Jennings says the displaced families are being housed either with relatives or at the Bad River Tribe's nearby lodge and casino. Long-term housing is still in the works. This year's crop of wild rice is still uncertain, but Jennings says the annual powwow dedicated to the harvesting of the rice will go on.
We still have to acknowledge, you know, that spirit for everything that it has done for us over the years and over the many generations that our people have been in this area. You know, a big thing is to also give thanks to everybody and everything that has been watching over our community and acknowledging all the help and assistance that we've received over this trying time.
Jennings adds that the storm has brought the community closer together. Marcus White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And Governor Scott Walker asked President Barack Obama's administration this week for a federal disaster declaration for 9 northern Wisconsin counties and the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. In the wake of those rains and flash flooding, a federal disaster declaration would mean the Federal Emergency Management Agency would cover 75% of local government's recovery costs. Walker is making stops in the region today to encourage summer tourists to continue visiting the area. On Wednesday, the Natural Resources Board approved a land swap that has prompted speculation of political favoritism. The state will exchange 2 acres of waterfront on Rest Lake in Vilas County for 42 acres on Man Lake, recently purchased by businesswoman Elizabeth Eline. The businesswoman and her husband donated millions for Governor Scott Walker's presidential bid last year. Natural Resources Board Chair Terry Hilgenberg says the exchange has a significant benefit for the state.
That particular parcel is bordered by, on 3 sides, by already state public-owned lands. So we're able to then be able to control much more water frontage with this traded property than what we had before.
Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission Chair Mick Isham testified against the land exchange.
We don't believe the land that's being traded here on Man Lake is equal to what's on Rest Lake. To us, again, it's Walleye Lake, it's a wild rice lake. Provides access to tribal members. To us, it's like trading away Aaron Rodgers for Cutler.
Cutler is the Chicago Bears quarterback. The land swap has also faced opposition from conservation groups who fear public access to Rest Lake would be restricted. The chair of the Natural Resources Board says that won't happen. And about 40 white-tailed deer farms won't have to upgrade their fencing under a rule approved by the board on Wednesday. The rule applies to farms that opt out of the state's chronic wasting disease monitoring program. The DNR's Todd Schaller says the rule doesn't lower deer fence standards.
It provides a low-risk alternative for a subset of white-tailed deer farms, which is consistent with standards we've had and maintained since 2001 to 2002.
Schaller says herds on unmonitored farms are still tested when animals die or are slaughtered. Tribal and conservation groups are pushing the state to require double fencing of all deer farms to help prevent the spread of chronic wasting disease. White-tailed deer farm owners say the cost of double fencing would pose a significant financial burden. The board also approved an emergency rule this week for a quota on cisco harvest in Lake Superior, but not everyone is happy with the state's proposal to limit harvest to 1.5 million pounds. The quota applies to state commercial license holders, but it does not affect tribal fishermen. North Wisconsin Rod and Gun Club President Dave Sorensen says all user groups should be held to the same standard.
In my understanding, the tribes have not agreed to this at all, and so you're putting a quota on a few of the commercial fisheries.
Sorensen says state recognition of Native American treaty rights has contributed to the decline of the state commercial fishery. Mick Isham with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission says tribes are probably the most regulated user group in the state.
Any inference that we're somehow depleting the resources is 100% false.
The harvest quota is set to take effect this October. And officials with the Lac du Flambeau Tribe in Vilas County have awarded a construction contract to Tribal Construction Group LDF-CCI to rebuild the band's Indian Bowl venue after it was torn down in 2014. President of the construction group, Robert Elm, says the tribe has used the Indian Bowl as a place for tribes to gather and share their cultures.
It's a time for sharing our heritage and giving people who don't know really anything about tribal culture, it really gives them an understanding of one section of tribal culture.
Elm says tribal festivities at the Indian Bowl drew thousands to the area, but he says such ceremonies have been on hold while the tribe has been raising funds for the new facility. The new Indian Bowl is expected to open next summer, and the cost to build the project is $1.5 million. The tribe is also raising funds to expand the facility to include a cultural museum and center located on the site. And researchers with the Center for Rural Communities at Northland College in Ashland will be releasing a survey to county officials about public perceptions of local water utilities next week. The survey shows a high number of people want to keep those utilities public. 92% of 640 households surveyed in northern Wisconsin say the state should make sure water from local utilities is safe to drink. The majority of those surveyed also say they would distrust a private company to run and maintain local water systems. Poll researcher Brandon Hofstadt with Northland College says national attention to drinking water issues helped shape the survey.
The falling out with some of the drinking water quality issues that had come to light in Flint, Michigan. So it became a hot topic and a national debate issue.
Hofstadt says recent proposals to withdraw water from Lake Michigan has prompted concern over whether similar plans could arise on Lake Superior. Poll numbers show about 76% of households do not want to see that happen. The survey also found that many residents are concerned with aging infrastructure for water utilities. And a replica Viking ship won't make it any further than Green Bay this summer. The ship was slated to appear in Duluth's Tall Ships Festival later this month, but the Draken says it's been unable to raise the money needed to complete the expedition in Duluth. After this weekend's event in Green Bay, the ship will leave the Great Lakes. This has been Wisconsin Public Radio's Week in Review, as covered by the Superior Bureau of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading. That's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. We hope to have you back with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend and a great rest of your week.